This is Alice, and on this episode, we have the incomparable Billie Jean King.
At birth, my brother and I, both of us, our third word that we learned was ball. Ball, daddy, ball, daddy, mommy, ball, ball. So anything to do with the ball, which tennis has a ball, I'm there. Like, that's why we played basketball first, because my dad was a basketball player. Yeah. He was a really good athlete. We love sports.
And your mom was a good swimmer.
My mother did not talk about herself, because in those days it was always about the dad. And I yelled at my mom later in life. I said, Mom, why didn't you talk to us about what you like, swimming and running? And she says, well, I wanted your dad to have all the attention. That is such a 1950s family. You know, it was always about dad being the one.
The course of Billie Jean King's life was written in the stars from the very beginning, it seems. She was a ferocious force on and off the court, transforming tennis and transforming the world for women. This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm your host, Alice Winkler.
Madam May, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Billie Jean King won 39 Grand Slam titles during her long career throughout the 1960s and 70s and into the 80s. She founded the Women's Tennis Association. She was the first woman named Sportsperson of the Year by Sports Illustrated magazine. She captivated the world when she played against and beat Bobby Riggs in what was famously called the Battle of the Sexes. Billie Jean King is now 81 years old, and sat down recently in New York with our interviewer, Mary Jordan. Mary is, by day, associate editor at the Washington Post, and there was a whole lot she wanted to cover with her trailblazing guest, including the first time Billie Jean stepped onto a tennis court at the age of 11 with her bestie, Susan Williams.
When did that magic moment happen when you thought, wow, I like this racket, I like this game?
First of all, my dad and mom wouldn't get me a racket. They said I had to figure it out. So I went to the neighbors and pleaded with them, and they were very sweet to me. They gave me quarters, dimes, nickels. I had a mason jar up in the cupboard. I put all my money in. I had $8.29, and I couldn't wait any longer. I'm just jumping up and down. I have to get my racket. And my dad says, okay, we'll take you now. That's good. We figured out how to do it. And so we went to Brown Sporting Goods in Long Beach, and I got my first racket. And I chose it because it was purple, and I love the color, you know, violets, purples. My mother loves it. And so the handle, the strings were all purple. Very low-end racket. You know, wasn't very high quality. Didn't matter. I thought it was beautiful. Slept with it. And Susan and I played on a softball team. And she told the coach, Val Halloran, oh, I took Billie to play tennis. She goes, you did? That's great. They give free instruction here every Tuesday with Clyde Walker.
That was like a city program?
Yes, it's all free, which was, I knew that I couldn't play tennis probably because Susan played at a country club, and that's where we played for the first time. And as we drove into this country club, I'm like, I'm not playing tennis. Why? No, we can't afford it.
Yeah, because your dad was a firefighter. You didn't have that much money.
No, we didn't have a lot of money.
But you were a good softball player. You were a shortstop, too.
Yeah, I was shortstop. The youngest one on the team. Lead off batter. I could usually get on base.
So was that natural timing or quickness? Or what was it that
No, God gave my brother and me extra. We were given extra in our coordination, but also our eyes. I know I wear glasses. That's a whole other discussion. People said I couldn't make it wearing glasses. I couldn't be number one. There'd never been anybody number one. I said, well, I think I will be. But I'm 20/10 with my lens even today. And my brother had great eyesight.
I don't understand that. You're saying that it's your eyesight, but you were famous for wearing glasses.
I know, but with my glasses, I see unreal. I can still see unbelievable. When I got to hit, I just see the ball really well. My brother and I have really good reflexes, really quick eyes, watch the ball well, track it well. You have to be able to track it all the way to the contact point to be really great. In fact, 50% are missed at the top level because we don't watch it all the way to the contact point. We watch it maybe when the ball gets 3 or 4 feet out before it gets to you. We start raising our eyes or our head to look where we're going to hit it or what we're going to do. So those are really basic things that Randy and I were given, plus I was quick. I like lateral movement. I had a good vertical jump, and I love running. I just loved it. The ball is magical, okay? Every time the ball comes to me, it's just magical to feel the ball against the strings. And you have to decide as the ball's coming, where are you going to hit it over there? But also you can hit topspin. Okay, I can do this because I put in the time and effort. You can think all you want, but if you haven't put the time in, it won't matter. But I can hit topspin, I can hit slice, I can hit side spin. You know, all these different choices. It's magical to feel the ball against the strings. I don't know what it is. It's just magical.
And it was there right from the start.
It's there from the day one. And I learned, okay, I go out to Clyde Walker the first day at Houghton Park, right? I figured out I'd been playing shortstop. I was the youngest one on the team in softball. Shortstop, maybe lucky if I touched the ball 6 times in a game. And I'm up once every 9 times as a hitter. I can hit 100 balls in less than 5 minutes in tennis. It was so easy for me to make that decision because of that. I loved it. And it's so demanding. Every ball that comes to you is so demanding. Like as a baseball player, if you're a hitter, you've got to really judge the pitch. You've got to figure it out. If you're a pitcher, you got to figure out what are you going to pitch. You're going to pitch inside, out. We do the same thing on serves. Am I going to go to their left hip, the right hip? Am I going to hit a topspin? Am I going to hit out wide? Am I going to go down the middle? Down the middle is the shortest distance. It's all math. Boom, boom, boom. I remember going to geometry class going, oh, I don't know about this. I go out to see Clyde that day. I go, this is geometry. Tennis is math. I love this. Angles, all this. Oh, magic. But you also start to realize, when I was growing up, people think you're stupid if you played sports. And it's not true at all. Usually the top players or top athletes are very much into a lot of things.
Like you.
You know, I loved history, so I immediately was reading all the great books on tennis. Well, most of the books were all about men, and usually it'd be all men, and one chapter might be on the women. So I always promised myself that if I ever got good enough, I'd make sure that we had some books on women players as well, which I've done.
What was the moment where you thought you could be number one?
Well, that first time I went out to see Clyde Walker with my new racket, it was at Houghton Park. I walked in. I met Clyde Walker, who I adored immediately. At the end of that hour and a half session, I knew I wanted to be the number one player in the world. I knew I'd found my destiny. I knew exactly what I wanted. And my poor mother came to pick me up. I go, Mommy, Mommy, and I'm jumping up and down on the seat, which we're not allowed to do. I go, Mom, I found out what I'm going to do with my life. And she goes, that's nice, but you have homework. You have all these things. I go, Mom, you don't get it. This is it. I want to be the number one player in the world.
And but this was after one tennis lesson.
Yeah, but I'd already read books, and I love books. I love history. So I knew that tennis was global, that was played all over the world, and I knew the men and the women both played, which I really liked. I didn't like, you know, sports are usually just for a guy or certain sports maybe for a girl. I don't like that. I liked the fact that tennis had both men and women. That was very important to me. And I was off on my adventure.
And then along came the famous day when you were wearing shorts instead of a skirt. You've got to tell us what happened.
Well, I've been playing for a year, and then there's a chance to try to get a ranking. you know, start seeing how good you are in Southern California. So you go to these different tournaments in your section to start going up the ranks. And the Southern California Championships are at the Los Angeles Tennis Club. So my mother reads, you know, what do you have to wear? She's all concerned. So she sewed me some shorts, and I wore a white blouse, and you had to wear all white. So she was really, okay, you have to wear all white. That's really important, which I did not like. I thought that was stupid. I still don't like it. I'm always arguing against it. So we go, and they have a photo of every kid in the tournament in front of the clubhouse out front. And I go, okay, this will be fun. My mother's all excited. And so I get lined up, and Perry T. Jones, who is the czar of tennis, comes walking out and says, little girl, you can't be in the photo. You're not wearing a skirt or a dress. I know what he's talking about.
So all the other girls had a skirt on, tennis
Well, they had to, because Perry T. Jones made us. Just, you know, he's really strict. So I got out of the, my mother is mortified, because she thought, oh, I mean, I read the rules. You're supposed to wear all, I had no idea about a tennis dress or, you know, a tennis skirt. And of course, I'm thinking, this is not a way to get a child into tennis. I'm thinking, you are so, I probably said stupid in my head, but I said, Mommy, I whispered to her, I remember, I went over and talked, well, I talked softly. I go, Mommy, don't you worry about this. We'll show them someday. She says, oh, I'm just so sorry I didn't do it right for you. I said, you did it great. The rules say all white. I'm wearing all white. I said, don't worry. In my head, I'm thinking, I'm going to be number one someday. And I'm going to wear whatever I want, and you better let me in the, you know, I'm like getting all riled up. And so that night, my mother went home and started sewing a dress for me. I'll never forget that night as long as I live. I was so angry, though.
And then how quickly, I mean, it was a couple more years when you realized, you know, hey, I'm pretty good. I'm like really good.
Well, the good thing was that I was never the poster child. It was Karen Hance, and she was on the front of Life magazine at 10. She was the one. And there were about, we had a Whiteman Cup team together in the juniors. I was probably number four out of those. Karen would say I was number three, but we voted, and I voted myself number four. She was so angry with me. You're number three. You shouldn't have done that. I said, it's okay. I don't really care. But I decided when I wanted to be number one, that every match I won, I didn't care about the juniors. What I cared about is every match was a stepping stone to being number one in the world. So every time I could win a match, I didn't care if it was 13 and under, 15 and under, 18 and under, that every time I won a match, it was really going to be the stepping stone to help me be number one as an adult.
But how did you not get discouraged with the matches you lost? Because you certainly lost some then.
Oh, everybody loses, that's for sure. And when you're a junior, you lose a lot. No, because it's what I can learn. You just got to keep learning all the time. And I tried to play more like an adult, not a junior. Juniors, the way they would win is just be steady and throw the ball up and just be steady. And in those days, you didn't have, when you were younger, you didn't have the power. As you got older, you had more power. So I didn't want to play like that. I was going to serve and volley. I was going to be aggressive. I was going to go to net. And I might lose as a junior, but I was still going to keep learning and keep getting better.
It didn't take long. Within about 5 years, Billie Jean was on her way to Wimbledon to play doubles with Karen Hans Soosman. They won. Billie Jean King would then go on to win 19 more Wimbledon titles.
The first year I went to Wimbledon, they didn't allow us to play both the juniors and the adults. And this is where Perry T. Jones really helped me. He calls me into his office. Now I think I'm in trouble automatically. And he goes, Wimbledon has just changed the rules. You cannot play both the juniors and the adults. I said, well, what do you think I should do? And he said, you should play in the adults.
You're 17. You're 17 years old at that point.
I was about, 17. And he goes, no, you should play in the adults. That is the greatest thing Perry T. Jones ever did for me. Besides, I mean, he was rough on everybody, especially the girls. He was much nicer to the boys. They paid for the boys to go back east, didn't pay for the girls.
Did you get paid expenses to go to Wimbledon that year? That was 1961, right?
Yes, I think we got $14 a day or something. We stayed in Karen and I stayed in a one room, £6 a week. You got to remember, this is 1961. And
you had no coach.
And we had
you?
Shillings. Oh, nope. No, I couldn't afford it. The way people see it today, it was just so different for us. We didn't have coaching. We didn't have anything. We helped each other. We had no money. Karen and I had $3 when we came home at the end of Wimbledon. And we won Wimbledon that year.
So talk about that match.
The USTA would come to you and give you an envelope of cash to get you through the 2 weeks. And that's how you made it.
But it was very little. And it was...
It wasn't really enough. But Long Beach, the Long Beach patrons... And the Long Beach Century Club helped send me to Wimbledon. Because remember, there's an airfare there, too, to get over to London. And then you've got the normal things that people have to go through. But we stayed in this one-room flat. And Mrs. Gordon was ahead of the whole household. And she didn't know us in the beginning, so she didn't give us very much for breakfast. And then as we started to do well and she started reading about us, we got a much better breakfast. I mean, we didn't get any toast. Then we started getting 2 eggs instead of one. And then Karen and I were, and then she started calling us her girls. So we thought that was hilarious. We had a good time with that.
So put us on the court that day. Just to remember that first Wimbledon win, it was the doubles.
Double play against Margaret Smith. Now Margaret Court, and Jan Lehane, who was a really good player from Australia. I knew all about them because I read everything. But Karen, before we played, kept telling me we could win. I go, Karen, and she's, we got to look at the draw. I said, I never look at the draw, except the night before. Who am I playing tomorrow? She goes, no, to come in with me. I go, no, it's bad luck. I don't want to look at the draw. She takes me over. We can beat this team. Now, remember, Karen went to Wimbledon the year before, so she's the vet now. And she's saying, we can beat these people. So here we are at Wimbledon. We're playing, Margaret Smith and Jan Lehane, and we did beat them. And we were the youngest team ever. Karen was 18. I was 17. And we're still the youngest team ever to have won Wimbledon.
How'd you celebrate?
We didn't have any money. We had to eat, dinner. But they have a Wimbledon ball, and everybody says, are you going to the ball? And we're going, what? I said, well, I'm assuming you have to have a nice dress. I said, well, of course. And we're going, we're not going. So Bud Collins, who was a great writer for the Boston Globe, found out that we couldn't go to the ball, and he comes and he says, I'll take you to dinner tonight. How's that? And we went across from in this basement very near Harrod's, and we had an Italian dinner, and he said, well, let's get some champagne. And we said, no, we don't drink. And I always remember Bud saying, God, this is great. You're such cheap dates, It's like so cute. But Bud became a great friend, and I loved him. He was a great guy.
Well, that was the beginning of an amazing Wimbledon run.
Yes.
And I just saw you there, days ago. Next photo that we were
out. I haven't missed a year since 61 except for COVID.
And this year, I saw you, and so the whole world, right next to Kate Middleton.
Yeah, well, Kate and I've known her now for a few years. We went to lunch. They had a lunch with her and Megan and about, 7, 8 years ago. I've seen her a few times now, she and William, and she's fantastic. She's an athlete. So she's truly there because she loves it. She loves tennis. She plays quite well, actually. She's good in everything. Really good. William always tells me she's the best athlete in the family.
It's an incredible story from this, kid who didn't grow up with much, certainly wasn't going to a country club, to hanging out with the royal family in England. And it would be in 1966, right, when you won your first singles championship.
Well, you've done your homework.
But that must have been so exciting. That must have been so exciting.
Yes, and I had to quit college to do that. I was married by then to Larry.
Larry King.
Yeah, Larry King. He was great.
Larry William King, Billie Jean's first spouse, was a sports promoter, not to be confused with Larry King, the broadcaster. Billie Jean was born Billie Jean Moffitt. She met Larry King and got engaged to him when they were both students at Cal State.
So I won my first Wimbledon as Mrs. Larry W. King, or LW. They put up on the boards where they keep all the winners. And he hated that. He's such a feminist.
They didn't put your name.
They put his name because
wow.
I'm Mrs.
Wow.
And I thought it was great. I was very old-fashioned. It's fine. I'm okay with it to a point because I loved him. And I thought, oh, this is good. His name's up there. But he said, this is ridiculous. He is such a feminist.
And did you get the same winnings as the winner of the singles men's?
Oh, there wasn't any winners then. There was no money yet. That was $14 a day still.
What was your prize for winning?
I didn't get a prize. What did I get? I don't think I got anything. Oh, maybe a gift voucher, I think, but Fred Perry helped me out to get home. He gave me the money for it. He was a great player. He won in 34, 35, and 36, and he was a great guy. Fred Perry clothes, that's the Fred Perry. And he gave me some cash to help get home for the plane ticket. So it's a very different world now than it was then. But the world I dreamed about as a child, when I started tennis, I wanted tennis to be a professional sport because pro means you're really good, and amateur means it's a hobby. And this was not our hobby. This was it. And so I've been fighting, and I had a vision for our sport at a very young age. I must have been 12, 13. I had my epiphany at 12. So I was off and running.
But so we have to talk about the most watched tennis match
Bobby?
In history, right?
Yes.
Bobby Riggs. So now you are like 5 years in a row, right? You were the number one in the world.
Was that 1970? Four or five years, I guess I was number one. Didn't really look at that much. I always was looking, what do I have to keep doing? Where are we going?
But along comes hustler Bobby Riggs. And it is stunning what he was saying.
He kept following me for a couple of years, actually. We had our first tour. We had nine of us sign a $1 contract in 1970, September 23rd, 1970. Nine players. I don't know if you've seen that photo. We're holding up a $1 bill. That is the birth of women's professional tennis the way you know it today. That is the birth. The Gladys Hellman is who we signed the $1 contract with.
And she was key in
helping.
She
was very key because she went and got the sponsor, Philip Morris. She also, being a publisher, Larry said she'll know all the CEOs. And she knows all the, she'll know all the advertisers. And that's how we're going to make this happen. The very next year in 71, we had a tour. We finally had a tour, a lot of tournaments, in 1 year. And I told Larry in December of 70, I said, you know what? If I can win over 100,000 next year, maybe they'll watch the tour. They'll keep track every week, and then they'll get to know all of us players. And then they'll think about women's tennis. And so I said, you know what? I'm really going to try to make over 100. I think the top male athletes make about 150 or whatever. But if I can make over 100, I think we might get noticed. We have to get people to watch us. And hopefully it'll inspire children to have the dream that they can do it, and there'll be a place for them, as a pro when they grow up, not what I grew up with as an amateur. So I'm thinking, if we can do all these things, but I want to win over 100,000, I don't know how I'm going to do that, because usually the winner got 1,800. At our tournaments, if you won doubles, it was 500 for the team, so you got 250, so you're around 2,000. If you can win, that means if you win everything. We're starting the tour. Gladys didn't know how she was going to sign us. I said, just sign us up for $1 as a contract pro, because that way we can legally do that. And she says, well, $1, you guys aren't going to sign. I said, yes, we will. I said, that's my job. I have to get the other players to say yes. So you'll see this $1 bill we're holding up. That's how that happened, because Gladys goes, I can't afford you guys. I said, can you afford $1? She says, yeah. And I said,
because you were so determined.
But because Larry's a lawyer. He's going to law school. So I know that it's just as binding as $1 trillion. And you would do that for $1? I said, yes, we would. Are you kidding? We'll sign up with you in a heartbeat.
And the reason you were willing to do that is the point you were trying to make is to make it what? Like just
professional.
Yeah.
We want to be pros. We're going to get paid. We got to go and get prize money. So we had prize money for 1 week in 70. And I kept saying, Larry, this is great. We have 1 week, but what are we going to do after that? We need a tour. We got to have a lot of tournaments. So
Gladys helped with the Virginia Slims tour.
She went and got Virginia Slims. We went and helped get promoters. We kept telling promoters, if you do it, you're probably going to lose your shirt. But will you do it? And they said yes. I mean, I can't believe how great some of the people were that owned tournaments in the beginning.
But I just want to remind people who are listening who might forget that at this time, like in the early 70s, There were about 50,000 men in college on scholarship for sports. Well, and there were
fewer for Title IX.
And there were fewer than 50 women. So the inequality was just stunning. And just across the board in sports, even in high school.
Oh, it's terrible.
Women were told home ec, not sports, right?
I was told to go into home ec. We had sports in Long Beach. See, that's another thing. Long Beach was an amazing city. Free access in the park system, right? That's why I made it in tennis, because of Long Beach. The people got behind us. I'm very indebted to Long Beach. I love Long Beach.
But
it's
even
fantastic.
President Nixon signed Title IX.
He did
right?
sign, and then we did talk.
Which said, you know, that there had to be equal opportunities in educational settings for women. Based on sex, right? That
right.
they had
but
to
if,
have
But if you
the
look
same.
At Title IX, it's good for everybody to read. It's only 37 words. It will not mention classroom quotas, or it will not mention sports in it. But let me explain what it did. There's the word activity in it. The reason we have athletic scholarships for women in college is because that one word, activity.
So it meant that if you were getting federal funds.
Any activity in school. Well, sports were activities. The boys were in these activities, and they have all these opportunities. Well, the girls are supposed to have them as well. That's the reason. We still do not have as many opportunities as the boys did in 1972 when Title IX was passed, June 23rd, 1972.
And then along comes Bobby Riggs, and he says things like, women belong in the bedroom and kitchen, in that order. And then he said, women play about 25% as good as men, and so they should get 25% of the money.
Well, I'm glad he thought we should get something.
Now, how mad did he make you?
Before Billie Jean answers that question, let me just explain a little more about Bobby Riggs. He had been a Wimbledon champion in 1939 and a U.S. Open champion, too. He was also famously a hustler, a gambler, a showman, and a self-declared male chauvinist pig. But
he was one of my heroes because I read history. I knew all about him, and I'd seen all the clips on him. But he knew nothing about me, which is also very common, that the woman will know a lot about the guy and the guy will not know too much about her because he doesn't ask her questions usually. And it's the way we're socialized, okay? Men are socialized to be brave. Girls are socialized to be perfect. You can never be perfect, so that's why we never think we're good enough. The guys are taught to be brave. They're not going to feel brave all the time. Nobody feels brave all the time. So the way we're socialized is really difficult, and that's what I really study a lot and think about a lot, is the way we're socialized. And if men and women think about it, the men have the power, actually. They can change it overnight. The men are the ones who can change sexism and all these things quickly, because they still really do have the power. But they I don't think they've really thought about what they could do to change the world, to make it a better place as much. They think about winning and beating somebody, but like Bobby, it's about beating us down. Rah, rah. But how can you make the world a better place? And I think if the girls and boys were socialized differently, I think we could do it.
But so at this match that was so heavily promoted, it was on TV.
I kept saying no. He kept coming back to me. Billy, you got to play me. You got to play me. We'll make lots of money. I go, Bobby, no. This is not about tennis. This is about much deeper than I cannot tell you. Culturally, this is so deep. And he goes, oh, no, we'll just make lots of money. That's how he's thinking. And I'm like, he doesn't get it.
Bobby Riggs was in his 50s at that point and had retired from pro tennis years before. What he wanted was another moment in the limelight. When he couldn't convince Billie Jean King originally to play him, he turned to Margaret Court, another top player, an Australian. But that ended in a humiliating defeat for Margaret Court. At that point, Billie Jean King knew she had to take the bait to strike a blow for womankind. She agreed to play Riggs in what was promoted heavily, endlessly, as the Battle of the Sexes, one of the most anticipated events in sports history. It was held at the Houston Astrodome in September of 1973, just 3 months after Billie Jean King had launched the Women's Tennis Association and won all three titles at Wimbledon, singles, women's doubles, and mixed doubles. But while she was celebrating her triple crown, Bobby Briggs was on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, engaging in a little trash talk.
You know, she's carrying a banner for the women. Billie Jean King.
Do you like women? So a lot of people said you don't like women. This is really more than just...
I like them real good in the bedroom, the kitchen, and when they bring you the slippers and the pipe. And, you know, I really think...
You're a male chauvinist, eh?
I really think the best way to handle the women is to keep them pregnant and barefoot. This way, they don't worry about getting out in the men's world and competing for jobs and trying to get equal money and all that baloney. And they stay in their place and they help their men, and they're behind the throne, because I really believe, Giant.
You want them out plowing the fields, don't you, and just having kids?
The male is king, the male is supreme, and the women should know that. To bomb Billie Jean King
really
in this match
do.
And set back that women's lib movement about another 20 years.
What was the pressure like on you?
I like pressure. That's what makes me. That's if you're going to be a jock, if you're going to be a champion, what are you going? You're going to have pressure every day. People have pressure every day of living, getting enough food on the table. Come on, pressure's there.
But like, some people get physically sick. Some people pass out.
I understand.
If I
get an injection, that's what happens.
You are famous for saying pressure is a privilege.
Yeah, that's my saying.
Tell me about that. Like, what is it? It's a privilege because it motivates you.
How many people get a chance to play professional tennis in the first place? How many people have a chance to play Bobby Riggs? How many people have a chance to be in the finals of Wimbledon? How many people? It is a privilege, and it's what I wanted. Therefore, I appreciate it, and I want it. I want that pressure. I want to be out there. I want to go walk on center court while the past champions have gone and the future champions are going to be out there. What about the people that never even got through qualifying to play on center court? I'm really lucky, man. That is just... Whoa.
But you don't think like, oh, my God, I'm going to... What if I have the most horrible game in front of millions of people?
That did cross my mind. But then I would just turn it upside down and picture myself winning every point, running every ball down. I just kept picturing myself doing it right.
Right before that match, it was incredible. You said you did 200 sit-ups every day and 400 leg lifts a day.
Yeah, I think you have to do at least that stuff, yeah. And then I also... Pete Collins, who was the pro at Hilton Head Shipyard, I was a touring pro there. I had him hit a lot of lobs to me because I figured Bobby would lob. He had great touch and, you know, good lobs, and he's going to make me run. And my job is whatever he gives me, I take care of it. So, and also you have to adapt very fast because Houston, we'd never played on the court. It was over a basketball court, and it was really dead. I thought, that's good for me, I think.
What do you mean dead?
It's like it doesn't bounce very much. It's real low bounce. It stays low. You got to get under the ball, up to the ball, up to the ball, up to the ball.
You've won on every surface, right?
Yes. Yeah, I like every surface. I wish I'd play more on red clay. I really love red clay, but I wasn't allowed to play on it when I was younger. They made us play on the grass court tour. That meaning the USTA, the governing body. The USLTA at the time, the governing body, they would make me come back home and play on the grass. I wanted to stay in Europe and play on red clay. But they used to sign off. They owned us. I mean, Perry T. Jones used to have to sign my entry to go to a tournament.
And so Bobby Riggs is heavily favored by the odds makers.
Oh, he's totally in Vegas and every place. Oh, it was a joke.
I was so impressed
when I read
your book, All In, that you said to get ready for that, you visualize the win.
Always. But I visualize everything anyway.
And what Billie Jean King saw in her mind's eye for that match, she delivered in straight sets.
You know, so many people have talked about that amazing win. So you won. The odds makers lost, you know, all those people that bet on the favorite.
Beating Bobby was absolutely, I had no choice. I told Larry, I have to beat him. If I don't, it's non-negotiable. I have to find a way.
How
no
did that
what.
Change your life?
Well, I told Larry, if I lose this match, the rest of my life will be, oh, there's that girl lost to that guy.
People talk about that match because it was at this pivotal moment for women's rights.
Well, think about it. We couldn't get a credit card on our own. I remember going to the Philadelphia Bulletin after that match, and they're all coming up screaming, yeah, they're clapping. They're going, Billy, Billy, for 10 years, we wanted to ask for a raise. We never had the courage. And when you beat Bobby, the next day we go in and we ask for the raise. And I go, great. Most importantly, did you get the raise? And they said, yes, we got the, because girls are taught not to ask for what we want and need. We're told not to do that, to always worry about the other person. But they did ask for what they wanted and what they needed, and they got it. And they were so empowered. The women came up to me all the time like, I'd never had the self-confidence. I didn't believe in myself. I was never going to try to be this or that. Now I am. Now I have dreams. I never had dreams. So the women are coming up. And then the guys would come up, and they were always more reflective, and like some were crying. The women weren't crying. The women were all like jacked up. The men would come, and then we'd have very calm discussions. And they said, you know what? I never thought about it until that night. And I have a daughter and I have a son. And I promised myself after that match that I want equal opportunity for my daughter and my son. And then I met President Obama. And he said, Billy, I saw that match when I was 12 years old. And it changed my life because I had started to think about women and girls and everything. And guess what? I've had two girls. Michelle and I have two girls. And I think I've done a better job raising them with Michelle because of that match.
Wow.
So these are the kinds of things that, wow, how it's affected people.
What was it like when President Obama gave you the highest civilian honor, the very first female athlete?
Is that
to
scary,
get
though? Can you believe I'm the first woman
Presidential
athlete?
Medal of Freedom.
I'm the first woman athlete to ever get the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Obama. It was fantastic. It was his first year, 09. His hair was all still black. He didn't have no gray hairs yet. To be the first woman athlete was a breakthrough, but in my heart of hearts, I knew that Althea Gibson deserved it, Wilma Rudolph, Babe Dietrichson. I mean, I knew a lot of women that should have had it, but because they're women, no one thought about them.
But what gives you the most satisfaction in life?
I don't know. I haven't thought about that. I'm always thinking about the future, like, what, we got to keep going. We're not even close.
Do you ever pray before a match?
Yeah, I did when I was younger, a lot. I was very much into Christianity and all that. You know, you have to understand, when you have Reverend Bob Richards as your minister, from the time I was about 11 or 12 to 15, Reverend Bob Richards won the bronze in 48, the gold in 52 and 56 in the pole vault. He was the guy that used to be on Wheaties all the time. He was a motivational speaker. I'd go to his sermons on Sunday.
He just happened to be your minister?
Yes. This was meant to be. I'm just telling you, it's weird, isn't it? I knew it was meant to be when I had him as my minister. I used to watch him practice next in this dirt field. He had a pole vault thing set up. He had hurdles. He was running I used to go watch him practice.
How important was he in your life?
He was very important because he was such a motivational speaker. When you would hear his sermon, usually always had sports in it, and you think you could do anything after you heard Reverend Bob Richards. Now, but I heard he became mega right or something. I'm just like, I don't want to know. I don't know. I just love his sermons. If you look him up to this day and hear him speak, you think you could do anything. You got to imagine 11, 12-year-old girl listening to this. I mean,
give us a sense of you're 11, 12, you're there on Sunday. Here's this Olympian athlete.
It's a Church of the Brethren, which is very low-key, wooden, no ornamentation. All I know is people were very kind and good, very basic. Don't drink, don't smoke, just, you know, like things like that. My dad said, if you want to be a great athlete, do not drink or smoke.
And you didn't.
And I'm a goody two-shoes with my dad, absolutely. My dad said that, I'm there. My brother, not so much. You know, like, okay, Dad, no.
Would you say that you're religious or spiritual now?
No, I'd say I'm spiritual. I wouldn't say I'm religious. If you look at my life, there's no way you couldn't be at least somewhat spiritual. There's no way. It was in the stars. Look how I thought as a child. It hasn't changed that much either, I guess. I think my brother and I got really lucky with our parents They never asked us if we won. And I still think that this is one of the strongest messages I can send to every parent. Don't ask your child if they won. Don't say it. Like, Yvonne Gulligan's a perfect example. She's Indigenous Australian. Her mother would always say to her, "Have a lovely day." She'd come home after her match, and she'd say, "Did you have a lovely day?" She was also number one in the world. You talk to number ones. I think they got really lucky, usually with the people around them, their parents or whoever. Well, I would go crazy when I lost. My brother and I are not sweet little quiet. No, we're like, I said, "I can't believe I lost." And I'm ranting and raving. My dad goes, hold on. "I'm just going to ask you one question. Did you try your very best?" I go, "Of course I tried my best." He said, "That's good enough." He said, "You might have to ask yourself, are you practicing enough? Or maybe you're practicing too much." "Too much? Yeah. You've burned yourself out, maybe." You have to ask yourself these questions. But if you think about my dad, what he did is he helped me with delayed gratification. He wouldn't buy the first tennis racket I wanted, right? Well, go back to when I was 3 years old, I wanted a baseball bat. And he says, "No. I want to know if you really love it or not." So he took a 2x4 and cut out a paddle for me. He says, "And I'll pitch to you every day, whenever I'm home." As a firefighter, he's home every other day, which is another really helpful thing. So I go, okay. So I would hit for 3 hours in a row. My poor dad. But look at my dad would stay there for 3 hours with his children. I'm hitting every day. My poor dad. I'm like, Daddy, let's go play. So finally he stops. He says, "You know what? I can see you love it. I will buy you a baseball bat now." But my dad was teaching me, and I don't know if he realized it, but he really taught us delayed gratification. Like, when you want to be the number one in the world, there's a lot of delayed gratification. A lot. I got really lucky. And Reverend Bob Richards was one of the lucky parts of my path.
What would you say was the hardest time of your life?
The hardest?
Most difficult.
The 70s and when I was outed, for sure. I couldn't talk about what I was feeling. I wasn't allowed to. I was taught. I didn't know my sexuality. I'm trying to figure out who am I. Larry would not give me a divorce because I needed to just go find out who I am. He and I should have just moved in together, I think, as younger people. Would have been great. But in our day, we didn't do that. Now the kids do. I think it's smart. You really know if you can get along or not. And I wasn't allowed to talk about it or else we wouldn't have a tour. So that made it real simple, which was really hard on me. I mean, I can't really talk about it. I don't know who I am, what I'm feeling. Am I gay? Am I bisexual? Am I this? We didn't talk like that in the 70s. You just didn't talk about it. And even some of the gay kids, which weren't that many, everyone thinks every woman athlete's gay, which is just a joke. We run the gambit, okay?
But you lost a lot of endorsements.
Well, when I was outed, I lost everything overnight.
Millions of dollars.
Yeah, millions. Because I finally was I was 37 or 8, and I was just getting lifetime endorsements for the first time because my generation didn't get that many endorsements. I was very lucky. I'm the first woman athlete to ever have a shoe in my name. They always talk about the basketball players. Well, I think Cheryl Swoops got hers in 95, while mine was 72. So I was the first woman athlete ever to get a signature shoe. And from Adidas, if you're in Europe. And that was pretty amazing to have that. But in 81, when I was outed, I just lost basically everything overnight.
When people read about you and hear you speak, you know, you're so upbeat. You have this great smile. your record, your awards. I mean, my God, the there's the Billie Jean King Tennis Center. They renamed Flushing's Meadow, which has the biggest
the U.S. Open
tennis stadium
in
the world, you know, now is in your name. Mm-hmm. The awards.
Can you imagine? I was suspended by the USTA, and now the whole facility is named after me. The main thing is I don't take things personally. okay? Like Ilana, my wife, she goes, I don't know how you do it. How do you do that? I said, because it doesn't do any good. You don't take things personally when people say something.
But it must have been awful when you lost all that money.
It was horrible because I had to start over. I had to, financially in every way, I had to start over. Done.
So what advice do you have for people? How do you get out of the low points? You know, people have said it's really tough on great athletes, right? They die twice. When you retire from your sport.
And you're young.
And when you really pass away.
If you want to be an athlete, things are going to happen when you're young. You better have plan B. And that's where I always try to help players and everything. I remember sitting with Chris Everett one time, and she wasn't number one anymore, but I think she was 3 or 4 in the world. And I asked her, do you still like to play? She says, oh, I love to play still. I said, do you still think you can, do you entertain people really well? Can you tell the way they respond to you? She says, oh, they're fantastic. Well, I said, is that enough for you? I said, you know that every year we make more money, even if we don't do as well. She says, I know that. She says, you know what? I still love to entertain the people. I'm going to play a couple more years, I think. And she did. But you have to ask. You have to sit down and have a really quiet, thoughtful. If you need to talk to somebody else, maybe, maybe not. But you have to ask yourself. But I knew as a young person that I would have to do something else after 35, probably, or after even 30, maybe. I don't know. So you've got to get on it quickly. You got to get, if you want it, you better do it now because, you know, I think we all know if you're 30 years old or older, how fast it goes. So.
But you have plan B, C, D, E, F.
Yeah, I did.
So you are helping all women's sports, right? You have really.
But we also, Lana and I are part owners of the Dodgers. That's men's sports. My brother was a professional baseball player. So I do care about men's sports a lot. But I also think it's good for us to have representation as women, and we're gay. I think it's good. We should be inclusive. We need everyone. We need every human being matters. Every child deserves a dream. That's it.
That's Billie Jean King speaking to Mary Jordan for the Academy of Achievement. On our next episode, we'll hear from several Olympic champions who got to live the dream Billie Jean King made possible. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. We're going out here on a song you may or may not know was written for Billie Jean King by her good friend Elton John.
I used to be a rolling stone, you know. If a cause is right, I'd leave to find an answer on the road.
He wrote it in 1974 after she became a coach and player for a short-lived tennis team called the Philadelphia Freedoms. Elton John co-wrote it with his longtime lyricist, Bernie Taupin. And by the way, you can find Bernie Taupin featured on another episode of What It Takes, but I digress. Elton John was such a huge fan of Billie Jean King, he'd come to her home matches wearing the team uniform of the Philadelphia Freedoms. And she, in turn, was a mega fan of Elton John.
So one day we're going to one of his concerts. We're in the limo and we're in the back seat. And he goes, I want to write a song for you. I go, Elton, did I hear you correctly? He goes, yes, but what are we going to call it? I said, I don't know. I'm trying to get over the fact he's even going to think about writing a song for me. He goes, how about Philadelphia Freedom? And it's huge. People love it. They still play it all the time. But it's an honor to have a song, you know, written, especially Elton. He's amazing.
I've heard someone describe the two of you.
Separated at birth?
As so similar. And one thing they said was that you're both kind of shy, introverted people who love to perform in front of a big crowd, mm-hmm. Which is kind of funny.
That's true. No, but a lot of performers are very shy, actually. But I know God gave me something extra, and I think Elton knows it too.
What It Takes is made possible with generous funding from the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening.